Hello and welcome to another podcast at manxradio.com with me, Mark Tiley. And it's time for another guest from The Morning Show.
Mark Tiley, the nation's station, Manx Radio.
Welcome to another week of My Tunes on Manx Radio with me, Mark Tiley. And we've got a very fine guest for you today. We've gone to the top. Lieutenant Governor of the Isle of Man, His Excellency Sir Richard Gosney, joins us for the week. Thank you for coming in.
Right, thank you for asking me, Mark. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, we sort of jumped you a little bit because it was at an awards ceremony and I saw, well, you were there and I was there and I said, oh, I wonder if you'd like to. And you said yes. I was delighted you said yes. Have you agonised, just as everyone else seems to, over their music choices?
Very difficult indeed, because if you'd asked me to name 20 tunes, that would have been much easier than naming four. I guess everybody goes through the same thing. Because when you think about it, you've got most of us have got music from different periods of our past, as well as what we listen to now. And I went through all sorts of... well, I'm afraid I'm from the era. I still have got a massive cassette tapes, if anyone still remembers what those were. And although they're all a bit wonky, you can remind yourself, some of them are very dated. And some of them were less so. And then you move on to the CDs that I don't think people use anymore either, but for more recent stuff. Anyway, so we boiled it down, but yes, it wasn't easy.
Growing up in Oxford, was there plenty of music around in the home?
Yes, my parents weren't great music fans. The radio would be on, the television would be on, sometimes music, very, very old-fashioned, very dated music, talking about the 1950s now. But they gave me a record player. I don't know. I passed an exam that no one ever does these days called the 11 Plus, I think it must have been.
I remember.
Which marks one's transition from primary school to secondary school. And then I started buying records. In those days, they were either singles that went round at 45 revolutions a minute or LPs, long players, that went round 33 revolutions a minute. We'd just got through the phase of the old crank up the machine 78, so I don't go quite that far back. By then it was the beginning of the 1960s, and I was, like all my contemporaries, a child of the 60s, and music played a huge part in our teenage years and through university and the rest of it, and it was quite a varied diet, but mostly sort of the popular rock music or whatever of the day.
It is amazing how those tunes from those formative years, they stay with you. I remember my father telling me, oh, you won't like that when you grow up. How wrong he was.
And some of that music, to do it credit, has stuck. And I find my own sons, aged 30, 33, are listening to music which was recorded way back in that time, whether it's American groups or British rock groups or whatever. And sometimes they don't really know that these are geriatrics, the people whose music they play. But sometimes those geriatrics are still performing. And I was quite impressed. My 33-year-old, newly married, took his wife up to Edinburgh to see the Rolling Stones concert. And there you are. I mean, Charlie Watts is 80 if he's a day. But it still strikes a chord.
They're still going strong. Still going strong. A lot of your time in your career, and we'll talk about quite a lot of the various aspects during this week, have been in hot countries. Not like where we are now. But was it this volunteer teacher job in Kenya that started off your relationship with Africa?
Yes, I went out there as a gap student in the days when you had to have a gap if you went to Oxford or Cambridge, because the exams for those universities took place in December after A-levels. It doesn't happen much now. And so you've got 9 months to... And I went off and taught in a community school in the back of Beyond on the equator there. And that gave me a taste for exploring more than the time that a holiday would give you. 3 years later, tried my hand at joining the British Foreign Office. It's a bit of a lottery. They have a lot of people, and I don't think they ever pretend to get the best 20 or 25. But as long as they get a reasonable 20 or 25 from that difficult sifting system. And what they do in the Foreign Office, they give you a year in London, in those days anyway, talking about 1973, 74, year in London, learning to distinguish between the colour of the bits of paper in which you write to a minister and the colour of bits of paper you write to each other and other vitally important bureaucratic skills. And then they send you off to the far end of the world. And they sent me off to, in my case, to Indonesia, capital Jakarta. And I was a bit like the fellow in the end of the Graham Greene novel. You know, they said Jakarta, and I said, what's that? But you soon get to grips with it. And the great thing about the career I was in, I used to think, was you spend 3 or 4 years somewhere. And you have to get to grips with somewhere in 3 or 4 years. If you don't take to it at the start, it's too long to say, we can get through this. You can't get through 3 or 4 years if you're unhappy. So you make yourself happy by finding what the enjoyable things to do are. And that applied in that country and the 3, 4, 5 countries that followed.
Let's have our first piece of music, Zap.
The first piece of music is Dave Brubeck's Take Five, which was the first record I ever bought for that that record player that I was given by my parents when I was 10 or 11. And it's in a curious time signature, 5/4 time signature, which makes it quite distinctive. It was an EP. Now, people won't remember that. Now, it's an extended player. In other words, those little singles only went on for two and a half minutes. And this was slightly longer. And so you put it on an EP, which was a superior record. And it was definitely, I don't know how old I was, 11, 12 at the time, it was definitely a one-up thing to have known about EPs and gone and bought one. And that was the first record I ever bought.
Tuesdays, my tunes on Manx Radio, and my guest all this week is the Lieutenant Governor of the Isle of Man, His Excellency Sir Richard Gosney. Sir Richard, thank you again for joining us on this musical venture. Let's look at your career, and I want to sort of get a sense of being in Westminster, being in London, and being overseas, because there was a time when you came back and then you went over. Once you'd been away, were you itching to get back out there, having come back into the thick of it in London?
By the end of 3 or 4 years back in London, I think the appetite has come back and you want to do it. I think to do a string, too many overseas postings in a row, the appetite can get a bit thin. And as a diplomat, you've got to go into a room of people you don't know and you say, hello, my name's Richard Gosney, who are you? Unless you really want to know who they are, they can see through you and it doesn't work. So at the end of my career, for example, we did 3 postings in a row. I was ambassador in Indonesia, high commissioner in Nigeria, governor in Bermuda, and that was enough. That was 12 years, and leading up a team, being the British representative, if you like, in those places. But earlier on in the career, then you just tend to do one or two at the most abroad, and then you go back. And also it means catching up with the people and the evolution of process as much as policy back in London in between time. And I spent three or four stints in London, 4 years at a time, and was happy to do that, and it was good to do that. But I was also perfectly happy to get out.
Did it feel a little bit like coming back to head office sort of thing?
Yes, it is back to head office. The Foreign Office is quite a small place compared with a lot of ministries. And so it's not overwhelming. You can get to know people quite quickly and the people you work with. And one time, the first time I was back for 4 years, I was doing an arms control job, NATO and nuclear arms control. Spent a lot of time in the Ministry of Defence, but I also get to know the people inside their own office. The second time I was back, I was had the job of the character in the Yes Minister programmes, Bernard. He's a rather pedantic private secretary to the minister, and I did that for 4 years. And you come into contact with everyone then, and you travel around the world as a foreign secretary. It's a bit like a prison sentence, because there's no time for anything other than playing that role of Bernard, but it's the most stimulating, exciting prison sentence you could think of.
And that was with, Geoffrey Howe, John Major? Douglas Hurd as well?
Most of the time with Douglas Hurd, but yes. Started off with Geoffrey Howe and then John Major's brief time as Foreign Secretary.
But you've brought it up. I've got to say, how accurate? We all know Mrs. Thatcher loved Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister. Was it really a bit like that?
Only if you have a weak minister. If the minister is weak, then Sir Humphrey can trample all over him. If you don't have a weak minister, then Sir Humphrey knows his is an auxiliary role rather than the main puppet master. I had three very strong characters, very different characters in Geoffrey Howe and John Major and Douglas Hurd, and I knew the Sir Humphreys who worked through that period and as at other times, and they were good and they were very skilled, but they knew that what they were doing was topping up rather than substituting for the thoughts of the minister.
Interesting. You mentioned Indonesia, but Nigeria, was it 4 years or 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, three and a half years in Nigeria.
Yes. People forget how big that country is.
It's a big, with an enormous population, about twice the size of any other country south of the Sahara, and quite a very varied country across it. But it's kept its links with Britain very strong, and so the professionals there, who are good, the doctors, the accountants, the lawyers, are very often double accredited, if you like. They've taken their exams to become accountants or they've been called to the bar out in Nigeria, and then they do the same in London because it's easy in the sense that the bar exams are much the same in both those places. But they're not just binationals, they're bicultural. They feel comfortable in both places. And a lot of those became friends, and I keep up with some of them now. I go back to Nigeria occasionally one way or another and see them occasionally in London. So as well as being a country that, to be frank, a lot of diplomats spend a lot of their time trying to avoid a posting there because it's hard work. It's quite tough. It is a corrupt country. The Nigerians are the first to admit it, so you have to be on your guard with most people. But once you start living there and meeting these people and getting to know them, then it's extremely stimulating. And they do look to London tremendously. And so the British representative still has huge access, enormous access. And I used to get to know those ministers well. I'm one or two of them. You'd have blazing rows with. There was a wonderful fellow who was their Minister of Transport. He was an Oxford graduate, very polished fellow. And we had a blazing row about aircraft and where they should be allowed to land and whether they would ban British Airways from going into Nigeria because we didn't let the Nigerian airline land in Heathrow rather than Gatwick and all that stuff. We did it all by text message because we knew each other. And you could do. There are not many countries in the world where you do that. And so that was dread. And they'd 1,000 Nigerians a day put in for visas to go to Britain.
Gosh.
Hundreds of those should go to Britain. Several hundred should not. Mm. And distinguishing between the two meant that there was an army of people out from the Home Office and from the Foreign Office to make that distinction and give the visas to people who had very strong reasons for going to Britain and avoid landing Britain with the people who shouldn't have gone there.
Fascinating time. Let's have our second piece of music, sir.
Well, this is Bob Dylan. Again, the age I was, Bob Dylan has been a feature ever since I was a young listener of music, right through to the present. I think his latest album is very good. Again, a lot of his music are ballads, and the ballads go on a bit, and they'd be rather too long, I think, for your programme this morning. But there was one that has always caught me, where he does a duet with Johnny Cash, and it's called Girl from the North Country. And it starts off an album that was very popular in its day, Nashville Skyline. Maybe people still play it a bit. But for me, it summed up some of the best of Dylan's range of ability and his range appreciating different sorts of music with the grand old man of country western, Johnny Cash.
If you're traveling to the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there, for she once was a true love of mine. See for me that her hair's hanging down, it curls and falls all down her breast. See for me that her hair's hanging down, that's the way I remember her best.
If you go when the snowflakes fall, when the rivers freeze and summer ends, please see for me if she's wearing a coat so warm to keep her from the howling.
If you're traveling in the North Country Fair,
where the winds hit heavy
on the borderline, please say hello to the one who lives there, for she was once a true love of mine.
On My Tunes this week, my special guest is our Governor, Lieutenant Governor of the Isle of Man, Sir Richard Gosney. And we've talked a lot about overseas, and we've talked about working in the Sir Humphrey role. That was very interesting. Thank you for that. When we see a Governor on the Isle of Man, we generally see you out and about meeting people, doing things, representing Her Majesty at functions various. What's goes on in the office? What's the day job behind the scenes?
Well, a lot of it, frankly, is preparing for those events and deciding which ones we can go to, because my wife Diana goes to a lot of them as well, and which of them we're going to have to say no to. Usually say no only when we're double booked, where we would otherwise be double booked. There's some things that happen every year, people are quite understanding that we go one year, not the next, go the third year, and on it goes like that. So there's a certain amount of that. There is some serious paperwork, as I think probably most people know. I sign off the vast majority of new laws passed by Tynwald in place of the Queen, which is different here in the Isle of Man. That doesn't happen in Guernsey or Jersey, but here it does. If it's something that directly affects the interests of the Queen, or if it affects my terms and conditions, my salary or conditions, then I'm not allowed to sign it off, and that does go to Her Majesty, but that's pretty rare. So that happens when Tyndall is sitting, and that's not onerous. But I also sign off applications for British nationality from what the jargon has as third country nationals, in other words, people here who are from elsewhere in Europe or South Africa or Italy or India or wherever. And there's a steady trickle of those, and the law is such that it needs to be someone who is directly delegated to that role by the Home Secretary in England, because the law here about who is entitled to and the conditions for getting British nationality are exactly the same as they are in the UK. And that takes a bit of time, because although all the preparation is done by people in the Cabinet Office, the final decision, including a decision on good character, judgment of good character, is made. And I'm always conscious that if we in the Isle of Man were to give British nationality to someone who subsequently got into trouble in front of the courts in the UK, and they were to turn around and say, where did this fellow get his British nationality from? We need to put our hands on our hearts and say, yes, it was the Isle of Man, and it was absolutely right. He met all the conditions, and the fact that he's gone wrong since then wasn't our fault.
Exactly. It was all right when he came here, or she came here. Let's get a little bit of classical music in. What we'll do, we'll play a little bit of something now and then put the much more onto the podcast at the end of the week. And we're going to take a little bit from the Bizet's Carmen.
Well, Bizet's Carmen reminds me of time in Spain. In the mid-80s, we spent four very happy years in Spain. And now Carmen is set down in the south of Spain. We weren't in the south, we were in Madrid, but we spent a lot of time, and particularly in that city that is the setting for Carmen, which is Seville. And Seville in the spring, in the late winter, February, March, April, is the most delightful place on earth. For the summer, I'm happy to leave it to the tourists from from Britain, Germany, or elsewhere, because it's very warm. And the Sevillanos themselves, the big events for them are around Easter, the Easter week, Semana Santa, they call it, and then the feria, the fair, the spring fair. And we would try and get down for one or other of those in the years when we could. But we also spent a lot of time when we had a few days off going down to Andalusia, the southernmost part of Spain. So for me, that Carmen, which is a very dramatic story about the gypsy girl who falls for and is fallen for by the soldier, Don Jose, is very evocative. And the prelude, which I think you're going to play a bit from, is good stereo music, sets the scene for the whole opera.
Thank you.
So, Richard, you represent Her Majesty the Queen. She is the Lord of Man, and you represent her here. How often do you have to deal with Her Majesty?
Quite rarely, and it would be a bad sign for the Isle of Man if I were having to write to the Queen. I wouldn't write directly to the Queen, I'd write to her private secretary, because it would be a sign of things that needed to be brought to her attention that because they were of a concern. And I can honestly say that I haven't had to do that in the 4.5 years that I've been here. If I had, I might not admit it on your radio programme, but I wouldn't deny it the way I just have. It's a sign of the smooth relationship between the Isle of Man and the government in London. We always know that there's a link there, but the link is essentially with the Crown. The British government do various things for the Isle of Man, and they need to, and in the run-up to the 31st of December 2020, it's more important than ever in terms of what the relationship will be between the UK and the EU after the 31st of December, and that's important to the Isle of Man. So those links, but those are run by the Cabinet Office here.
Let's take today's main piece of music. What have we got, sir?
Well, today it's Nina Simone, who was an extraordinary singer, American singer, with a very wide repertory. One thinks of her, everyone's got their favourite songs, people who like her have got their favourite songs, but she could span across and she could do some popular-like classics just as she could do some popular rock music or jazz music. And she's got this very deep voice, it's quite distinctive. And again, choosing something that's representative is quite tricky, but she did, as a cover version, it wasn't her own song, I don't think, I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
1, 2, 3, I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Our final My Tunes segment of the week is here. It's come all too quickly. My guest all this week, Lieutenant Governor of the Isle of Man, Sir Richard Gosney. Sir Richard, when you came to the Isle of Man, what first of all surprised you? What did you find strange? Or were there things you weren't ready for?
Well, if I say no, that sounds a bit awful, doesn't it? Because one should be surprised everywhere you go. I think I was surprised by how deeply it reflected what I hoped it would reflect. And I don't mean that to be quite as brown-nosing as it may sound. Diana and I know that we like living in smallish places. There is an old-fashioned courtesy about them. There is a conservatism, if you like, conservative of the small c, not a political conservatism, and a politeness. And communities in smallish-ish places elsewhere, far side of the Atlantic, South Atlantic we had to do with elsewhere, tend to look after their own quite well. And I think one of the striking features of the Isle of Man is where the community does look after its own here without making a big song and dance about it. But when people get into difficulties, we've seen it this year with the result of the effect on certain businesses and families because of coronavirus restrictions here, then quietly but very effectively, people volunteer, or people who are in professions do double time to help out those people who are suffering. And obviously with the coronavirus, it was very clear there were people who couldn't leave home, there were people who shouldn't have left home to go and get their food and get their medicines, what have you. And the number of people who rallied around to do that was very striking. It wasn't a big surprise. It's the sort of thing I would have half expected, but it was wonderful confirmation that that's the way the island can work. But we also knew that we liked the scenery of what I think of as the Western British Isles, which can range anywhere from northern Scotland through parts of Western Ireland, Wales, Cornwall and beyond, which I had never lived in but visited and much enjoyed. And that's it. And you go along the Radnofolin here. We've now got to the stage, we know what we like, and so we don't do all the Radnofolin, but we know the favourite bits on the west and on the east of the island, that you get a scenery and a bird life and a remarkable lack of people. We tend to bump into the people we know because there's certain people who do those sort of things, but whether people we know or we don't know, there are very few of them. And we tend to do it on a Saturday morning, and it's a great way of starting the weekend.
I noted that you are keen on bird life and were supporting volunteering in Norfolk at one stage.
Yes, it's just down the road from our long-term home, which is by the Norfolk coast. North Norfolk coast, and there are one or two bird reserves there that are famous. When the birds are heading north in the spring, they want a final resting place before they cross the North Sea, and when they're heading south in the autumn, they certainly need a rest after crossing the North Sea, and there are one or two bits of the marsh there where it's famous. So you get these rarities and oddities, but you also get some birds nesting there, and they're amongst the more unusual birds of the coastlands of eastern England, and so the reserves there are popular, and I used to volunteer on Sundays, go out with a pair of binoculars, really to help the younger bird watchers. Because you get some of these twitchers, I say that in a tone that indicates my attitude to twitchers, who are desperate to tick off the rarest thing. Actually, more interesting for people who are starting bird watching is to know the birds, the unusual birds, but which you can rely on seeing and are regularly there. But those young bird watchers sometimes be a bit intimidated by these twitchers.
Let's take another little clip from the classical catalogue. I'd want to just get a bit of Rodrigo's concerto in. You mentioned it earlier, and well, it's a beautiful piece.
It is, and this is, again, reflects our time in Spain in a way. And this is central Spain. This is not southern Spain of Bizet. This is Aranjuez, just down the road from Madrid, and Rodrigo composed some lovely pieces, and this is one of them, Concerto de Aranjuez. We were there in the 80s when Segovia, one of the great guitarists, was still alive. And I remember going and seeing him in a small group of people, not a big concert. He was past that. He was already in his early 90s, and he could still work the magic, as he must have been 92, 93, on that guitar. Well, this is one of the most famous Spanish guitar composers, guitar and beyond, in the music we're going to hear. The Concerto of Aranjuez, which, as I say, is just down the road from Madrid.
You're leaving us, sir, next year.
Yes, I'm in denial about it. So is my wife, yes. Because we enjoy ourselves here and we're not going to think about it until rather nearer the time. But it's 5 years is the term for a lieutenant governor here, and that's about right. I'll be 70 when we leave, and that's that time when one should actually settle down somewhere for good before the Zimmer frame catches up with you. And so that's what we'll do sometime next summer.
So no more postings?
No, no. I think I don't pretend that I can be very useful to anyone 70 plus. There'll be things that we'll want to do, I'll want to do locally in Norfolk. We have somewhere we can stay in London as well. So going down there and either seeing people or perhaps joining in some of the activities there. Or indeed firms. I mean, having served in two of the biggest financially tricky countries in the tropical world, Indonesia and Nigeria, there were, after I retired the first time round 8 years ago, several companies whom I got involved with because they were trying to make sense of those. There's a lot of money in those countries, but there are a lot of pitfalls if you approach them the wrong way. Whether that I'll do any of that or not, I don't know. We'll see what people say.
You mentioned the spirit that you saw here during lockdown, people helping everybody, and you've seen it in your time here over the many years. What else will you take away from the Isle of Man?
Oh, a lot of friendships, I think, from people we've got to know and people we do things with and enjoy spending our time with. But also, I think mostly this abiding impression, which will become the abiding memory, of a community at ease with itself.
That is lovely to hear. Thank you, sir. Let's have our final piece of music.
Well, this is with Jerusalem, which is a piece of music that can often move me almost to tears, whether it's in the last night of the proms or it's hearing it at other time. And I've got a version here, which was sung by the WI Choir of the Isle of Man, involving people we know and directed by someone we've seen a lot of and respect, Karen Elliott. And I think it's a rather nice version of it. The CDI has two versions of it. This is the English language version, because I'm afraid, despite 4.5 years, the Manx language version I would find a bit harder to follow. It sums up a lot about the island, the fact that... And we've listened to a great deal of lovely music here, both on the stage in musicals and in concerts. And the brass band, I never believed you could really make sense of the last night of the proms entirely with a brass band. And Ian Clegg and the brass bands proved that you can do it, and that'll be another abiding memory from here.
Well, Sir Richard, thank you for your choices. Thanks for coming to talk to us this week. And may we, all of us at Manx Radio, wish you and Lady Gosney the very best for retirement, in inverted commas, I think.
Thank you. Not quite yet. No. Sometime next year.
Many thanks to the Lieutenant Governor, Sir Richard Gosney, for being my guest on My Tunes on Mark Tiley in the Morning. Keep popping back here for more podcasts, all shapes and sizes. And don't forget, you can subscribe if you'd rather, so you never miss a single edition.